Welcome to Tech Talk with Hawk. Tech Talk with Hawk is a weekly talk show discussing topics related to technology and its impact on your privacy, security, and civil rights. Content and or views, opinions, and conclusions expressed on Tech Talk with Hawk by the host, co-host, or guest do not necessarily reflect those of KYRS, The Nair Radio, LPFM, nor those of the station's staff or management. The show host is not a lawyer, and the opinions expressed by the show host, co-host, or guests are not to be construed as legal advice.
The opinions and conclusions expressed by the host, co-host, or guest should in no way be construed as an endorsement to purchase any product or service, nor are they intended to discourage anyone from buying any product or service or deprive any company of its lawful income. Furthermore, such opinions and conclusions are not intended to support, induce, or condone any activity that might violate local, state, federal, or international laws. The host, co-hosts, and guests have no liability to any listener or entity deprived from any alleged loss or damage arising from the use or misuse of the information provided during this show, including damage to computer systems, aid systems, equipment, accessories, injury, or any other problems or adverse situations directly or indirectly resulting from the show's content. This show makes no guarantees stated or implied regarding the validity of the information discussed on this show. While the show host makes an effort to ensure the information discussed is accurate, the host, co-hosts, and guests will not be held liable for errors, inaccuracies, omissions, improper use of information presented, or any violations of any law which may occur as a result of utilizing the information from the show or any inconsistency therein.
Has been working with computers and information technology since 1981. He has extensive experience with and has been certified in many technologies over the years, including but not limited to Microsoft, Novell, Sun, Java, Linux, databases, Oracle, information security, application servers, web servers, and many, many other technologies. He has worked as a software developer in many programming languages, worked in most of the areas of the information technology industry, from lowly technical support in custom personal computer systems builder to database administrator, network administrator, systems administrator, computer technician building thousands of systems by hand, webmaster, physical and information security specialist, research and development computer scientist to the pinnacles of Chief Information Officer and Chief Technology Officer. Hawk has worked for tiny mom-and-pop companies to large corporations with tens of thousands of systems. He has been published and certified as an Information Security Incident Handler by the SANS Institute, an institution focusing on information security originally founded by the NSA and the FBI. The goal of this show is to enlighten and inform the general public about technologies that do have an impact on everyone, and try to break the terms down as best as possible to be understood by most listeners. If any topic covered goes by too quickly, or needs to be explained in more detail, please do not hesitate to call in to the studio during show broadcast hours. That's Sundays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time. You may call in the United States, 509-747-3807. You may also contact the show host during show broadcasts through instant messaging and internet relay chat by going to the website www.techtalkhawk.com, or during any time you may email hawk at techtalkhawk.com. You may also download show archives, find links and addendum information, as well as post questions at the website www.techtalkhawk.com. That's TechTalkHawke.com. And now, your host, Hawk.
Yes, welcome to Tech Talk with Hawk, and I have here brand new co-host, Randy. Say hello, Randy.
Hello, everyone.
I'm really glad to have him here, and he's going to help keep me grounded and talking in terms that everybody out there, the average listener, can understand. The main feedback I've had is a lot of people love this show, but I sometimes get covering too many topics too quickly, and so hopefully Randy here will keep me grounded and keep things nice and clear for you. Today's show is going to have a special theme. I tried not to do too much Microsoft bashing on my show. But some people might construe this as that. I've found a really detailed analysis, a cost analysis of Windows Vista and its content protection by a professor out of New Zealand. And I'll be covering summary of that later on in the show. First, I'll go ahead and give you guys a few headlines from the usual sites, EFF.org, on what's going on there, Slashdot, various other sites. And just give a quick heads up of some of the things going on out there in the technology world. Again, the purpose of this show is to try to inform and enlighten the general populace as to the impact of technology on our daily lives, especially where they affect our privacy, security, and civil rights, whether it's laws being enacted or certain vulnerabilities happening with technology that are making our privacy more vulnerable, etc. And if the internet connection here is not running smoothly enough, then we'll just get straight into the cost analysis of Windows Vista, since it looks like I had a little trouble getting the headlines up here. So that's fine if that's the way it's going to be. That's the joys of technology on a live show. It's about 24 days away from the release of the new version of Microsoft Windows called Vista. And it was already released to a few corporate markets, a few corporate partners that had special access. And some of the feedback from there has been mixed. But the general public release is just about 3.5 weeks away. So I thought I'd do a little more research and find out where Vista is at now that it's pretty much in its final release stages, and what people are saying about it and what their experiences are with it. And something I kept stumbling across repeatedly was a lot of sites linking to the single document called A Cost Analysis of Windows Vista Content Protection by Professor Peter Gutman. And he is a professor of computer science in the computer science department at the University of Auckland, New Zealand. And he generally focuses his research on the design and analysis of security techniques and systems. And looking through his bio, he had pretty impressive background. He's been part of security both on the Windows side as well as non-platform security over the years. Some people might be familiar with PGP, which is a way people would sign their email signatures and it would show proof that that came from that one person, or they might encrypt their email so that it would be hard for somebody to sniff what their email contained. And he was part of that among many other projects that he was involved with. And he makes it very clear that he doesn't feel he's Microsoft bashing at all when he goes into this. He just did detailed analysis. He has a number of systems of his own. And I'll give you a quote directly from his FAQs regarding this. It says, before you tune this out, is just Microsoft bashing, listen to what the author has to say in response. It's bad technology bashing, not Microsoft bashing. If this had been done by Linus Torvalds, Steve Jobs, Alan Cox, or Theo Durrett — Linus Torvalds is the creator of Linux, I'm backing up here just to explain. Steve Jobs, of course, Apple. Alan Cox, I'm drawing a blank on that at the moment, and Theo Durrett is OpenBSD. And he said, continues, I'd have said the same thing about it. As far as I'm concerned, computers are tools to get a job done and not a platform for religious wars. And if something's bad, I'll say so regardless of who's doing it. Just for the record, I run various versions of Windows on, he counts, 7 of my machines. The rest are a mixture of Linux, FreeBSD, and occasionally Solaris. So I'd be a rather unlikely Microsoft detractor if I have their software all over my machine. So that's just a little bit of his disclaimer there, saying he's not grinding any particular axe towards Microsoft when he did this analysis. And whether you use Windows Vista, Windows XP, Windows 95, 98, or Millennium, Mac OS X, Linux, FreeBSD, OpenBSD, Solaris on x86, or almost any other operating system on a computer in the world, Windows Content Protection will make your hardware more expensive, less reliable, more difficult to program for, more difficult to support, and more vulnerable to hostile code, and with more compatibility problems. Because Windows dominates the market and device vendors are unlikely to design and manufacture two different versions of their products, non-Windows users will be paying for Windows Vista content protection measures in products even if they never run Windows on them. So I don't care if you're a Mac fan and you only use Mac, or you're like myself, an open source fan, this impacts everybody across the board. And it isn't really just computers, but we will mostly be focusing on that in this particular thing. The author claims that there's about 4.2 million sites linking to this document. Google showed around 30,000, but Google also filters out a lot of repeats. So this is a document that is being highly, highly referenced out there in the internet world. I'm going to define a couple of terms before we get into the meat of this. And these are critical terms to understand. There's DRM, which is Digital Rights Management, a.k.a. Digital Restrictions Management, a.k.a., and this is tongue-in-cheek, Defective Recorded Media. Combine all three, and you have a general idea of what DRM is. HD is short for High Definition, technically meaning video content of 1920 by 1080, so 1920 by 1080. That's a pixel resolution on the screen. People will be familiar with like 640 by 480, 800 by 600, 1024 by 768. So high definition is at least 1920 by 1080 resolution. But more generally, anything with better than generic TV quality resolution. In their specifications, Microsoft regards anything with more than 520,000 pixels or 800 by 600 resolution as premium content that needs to be downgraded before displaying it to the user. HD DVD, one of the proposed successors to DVDs capable of storing high-definition content. The other one would be the Blu-ray that people are becoming more familiar with. Everything clear so far on that?
Sounds good.
Okay. Executive summary. Again, I'm reading from this document from the professor, and this is made available under his Creative Commons, the Creative Commons license, which says basically as long as you give full credit to the original author, you can use whatever bits and pieces of it you want, etc. So it's freely shared. And I will give his URL here if you want to view the entire thing, or you can go to my website and I have a link to it as well. That might actually be easier. It's a long URL. But it's at the University of Auckland, New Zealand. That's A-U-C-K-L-A-N-D. If you go to techtalkhawk.com, then you'll see the link there, and you can look at the entire document. It's about 25 pages long, and so I just picked the highlights from it to save the burden of reading 25 pages of a very detailed analysis. So, enough preamble. Executive summary. Windows Vista includes an extensive reworking of core operating system elements in order to provide content protection for so-called premium content, typically high-definition data from Blu-ray and HD DVD sources. Is that clear so far?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Providing this protection incurs considerable costs in terms of system performance, system stability, technical support overhead, and hardware and software cost. These issues affect not only users of Vista, but the entire personal computer industry. Since the effects of the protection measures extend to cover all hardware and software that will ever come into contact with Vista, even if it's not used directly with Vista, for example, hardware in a Macintosh computer or on a Linux server, this document analyzes the cost involved in Vista's content protection and the collateral damage that this incurs throughout the computer industry. And then he has another one here, executive summary. And he has this down to one line. The Vista content protection specification could very well constitute the longest suicide note in history. And he's making a reference here. He says this comment was inspired by Sir Gerald Kaufman's similar comment about the British Labour Party's 1983 election manifesto, which resulted in Labour turning in its worst election results since its founding. It was so bad that Labour's opponents in the election reprinted and distributed it themselves. Maybe Apple could take a hint from this and use Microsoft's content protection details in their advertising for OS X. At 44 pages, Microsoft's output content protection in Windows Vista squeezes out Labour's 37-page manifesto to take the crown. So this guy has a little bit of a sense of humor, you know, and a feeling of history. Introduction. This document looks purely at the cost of the technical portions of Vista's content protection. This document uses cost in the sense of penalty, damage, harm, injury, and loss, rather than the more financial expense, layout, and price. And he goes on to explain how it would be really hard to figure out the exact dollar amounts. Nobody really knows exactly what the ramifications are. That'll take time to really understand what the TCO, total cost of ownership, impact is. That's a little buzzword in the computer industry with using technology. In order to work, Vista's content protection must be able to violate the laws of physics. And he gets, we'll get into that, what he means by that in a little, in just a few sentences here. And he says, this conundrum is displayed over and over again in the Windows content protection requirements, with manufacturers being given no hard and fast guidelines, with sentences like, it is recommended that a graphics manufacturer go beyond the strict letter of the specification and provide additional content protection features, because this demonstrates their strong intent to protect premium content. This is an exceedingly strange way to write technical specifications. I'm looking for the Politburo, you know, walk the party line here. So they actually have that in the technical specification document. So in order for content to be displayed to users, it has to be copied numerous times. For example, if you're reading this document on the web, then it's been copied from the web server's hard drive to server memory, copied to the server's network buffers, copied across the internet and through many other routers along the way that would be routing that information, copied to your personal computer's network buffers, copied into the computer's main memory, copied to your browser's disk cache, and finally copied to your screen. If you printed it out to read, several further rounds of copying have occurred, which I've done here. Windows Vista's content protection and DRM in general, again, that's digital rights management, assume that all of this copying can occur without any copying actually occurring, since the whole intent of DRM is to prevent copying. If you're not versed in digital rights management doublethink, this concept gets quite tricky to explain, but in terms of quantum mechanics, somehow that just doesn't help. But the content enters a superposition of simultaneously copied and uncopied states until a user collapses its wave function by observing the content. In physics, this is called quantum indeterminacy or the observer's paradox. Depending on whether you follow the Copenhagen or many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, things then get either weird or very weird. So in order for Windows Vista's content protection to work, it has to be able to violate the laws of physics and create numerous copies that are simultaneously not copies. Is that a mind bender?
That's lost me, yes.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the joke. I know what he's referring to roughly, although I'm certainly by any means a physicist, especially not a quantum physicist, but I understand that one of the basic concepts they have is that when you observe something at the quantum level, just by observing it, you change its actual state. So, for example, if it was in a vertical state before you observed it, you will observe it, let's say, in a horizontal state. Just because you observed it, you changed its state. That's how things get weird and very weird at the quantum level. Just by observation, you change what it actually was at. And so he's kind of getting to that whole paradox of, well, how can you keep something from copying if you have to copy it? Because you have to copy the content, even if it's on a DVD, it has to copy through the whole system and get onto your screen somehow, because on the screen is a copy of what's on the disk, and yet you're supposed to prevent it from being able to copy anything. Is that any clearer at all so far? Maybe, maybe not?
Well, the idea behind it, I guess, is
okay.
Clear.
Well, that's the thing, is if you can just get the general concept of what we're talking about here. And the main point being that they don't want pirates, as they refer to anybody who tries to copy content unauthorized. They don't want people to be able to copy DVDs. When DVDs first came out, 2 weeks before they were released to the public, and I've talked about this in previous shows, a hacker cracked the encryption on the original DVDs 2 weeks before it was available to the public, and the movie industry just went, well, we've invested so much in this, we're just going to have to live with it. And so DVDs were readily available over the internet after that. Now, he didn't crack it to make copies of DVDs. He cracked it so that he could watch movies on his open source hardware. So if he wasn't running Windows or Mac, which had, you had to buy a DVD player software, he wanted a version, if he was running Linux or BSD, he wanted to be able to watch his movies that he owned. He legitimately owned them. So he figured out how to crack the code so he could watch his movies on his computer. But by doing so, it made it so that others had the ability to copy the DVD. And then the whole Digital Millennium Copyright Act kicks in and all that. I'm not going to go into this because I've covered that in other shows in pretty good depth, unless you need me to clarify on that. But so that happened with DVD, you know, part one.
Okay.
And so the movie industry learned from that. And what they're trying to do now is make it so that if it gets cracked, that it can be uncracked. And we'll get in a little more detail about of revocation and how they do that. But their main concern is trying to keep it so that you can't go download movies and share them and make copies, etc. Even though base copyright law says you have a right to make a copy of your own product as long as you don't turn around and redistribute it. But the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says, yes, sure, you have a right to do that as long as you don't bypass any copy protection. to make an archive backup of your product. So if you have a DVD and you don't want to ruin your original, you want to make a backup.
Right.
Well, you've just violated the DMCA because there's encryption on the DVD, even though it's a piece of cake to bypass. You've just violated the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, even though you're not violating the original copyright laws that said you had a right to make a backup as long as you don't redistribute it. So that's what's been happening. They've been getting tighter and tighter on that. And one of the things that they're trying to do is make it hard to find a point to extract the video. So if you're reading the DVD into the drive and it has to flow through the hard drive and through the motherboard and through to the CPU and then the memory and then the video card, there are points along there where a good software hardware guy could figure out how to tap into a decrypted version. So they're saying you got to keep the whole stream encrypted the whole way. But they don't actually like encrypt it in certain key areas, and he explains that later. OpenBSD, which is an open source operating system, has a good idea as far as from security in that they randomize where things are stored in memory, so that's a lot harder to guess where this would be stored so that you could snag the images to turn into something. All right, disabling a functionality. So how does Vista do this? How do they keep people from being able to get to the content besides encryption? Vista's content protection mechanism only allows protected content to be sent over interfaces that also have content protection built in. What that means is a piece of hardware, if it's not Vista certified, won't be allowed to pass the data from, let's say, the DVD. I'm just going to keep using the high-definition DVD or Blu-ray DVD. So it's encrypted on the disk. The player has to be encrypted as it data passes through the player. Then as the data passes along the little, you know, SATA cable or whatever, hard drive cable from the CD player, DVD player, to the motherboard, that has to be encrypted. At the motherboard where the controller chips are that control your drive, it has to stay encrypted there. Then it has to flow through the processor and the memory, etc., to get handled there. Has to stay encrypted there. If any of it's cached to the hard drive, it has to stay encrypted along that whole chain. Then it has to go back through the motherboard and to the video card, and that has to be encrypted that whole way. Then from the video card, it has to go along the video cable to your display, like an LCD, and that cable, that needs to be all encrypted between the video card and the monitor. And then the monitor is your final decryption. And Vista has to check that every one of those devices is not decrypting before it's supposed to decrypt, and that the item that does finally decrypt it is authorized to decrypt and show it on the screen. And if at any point any one of those devices is not quote-unquote certified, then all they'll see on the screen is either nothing or a really low-resolution version of the content. They won't get the HD version of it.
Okay.
So that's how they're trying to lock people out with that. So,
let me stop you for a sec.
Yes, shoot.
If we step back a point, you talked about open-source users cracking DVDs so that they could play it on their open source equipment.
Right.
Or their
they cracked the key that was on the DVD.
Okay, so is that is this just the next step in that same element where they have equipment or software that was not able to play the DVD encrypted?
That has already happened, actually. There's a guy out there, I'm forgetting the hacker name right now, but he wanted to play one of these new HD DVD, Blu-ray, high-definition DVDs on his, I think, Linux computer. It might have been BSD. And he couldn't because there was no player available. And so he hacked away and hacked away and hacked away, and he was able to get the encryption key to the title, and then from that, he was able to view that specific movie. Now, in the past, if he cracked one or two or three discs, then he'd cracked all of them in the entire industry. But now they have different keys for each disc, so it's a lot more difficult. So yeah, he's cracked this one specific piece of plastic so that he can view his own movies, and then he can relay that information to others, but there's only like one movie or so, and only a limited batch of them that will be able to be cracked that he's done that with. And there's still some contesting about there about whether he actually pulled that off or not, because sometimes hacker bravado gets out there and I cracked it, no you didn't, I did,
right.
But whether he did or didn't, it's only a matter of time. But the point is, it's a lot harder this time than before, because the movie industry really did make it a lot harder. They have a whole bunch of different keys, and as they put new printings, you know, burn new discs, they're gonna have a whole new set of keys. Not only that, they're keeping a record of invalid keys, and then when you stick that in the computer with the invalid list, it updates the database on your computer of invalid keys. And so if you cracked a disk and then you stick in a new disk, it will then invalidate the ones you cracked before. So now you can't play the ones you were able to play before. So you can see how they're playing a little cat and mouse game there with the hackers to try to do it. So, and the same thing will happen through Windows updates. You'll get a Windows update pushed to your computer, and it'll update that list of blacklisted keys. And now all the movies that you were able to play before, you can no longer play. Now, again, that's if you're under Windows, and then you probably already have like Power DVD or whatever, and you can play it. And although apparently that's how he did crack it, was there was a fault in Power DVD that it exposed the it left stuff unencrypted in memory, and so he was able to figure it out from that.
Okay.
So they're still working out the bugs.
So let me see if I understand
this.
So with in the past, the DVD technology, the software that you would buy that would play it,
right,
that is where the encryption was taken care of and so on.
That's where it was decrypted, yes.
Okay.
The processor would do the CPU would do the actual processing, but the software was in the DVD playing software. You know, if you go buy a DVD drive, you'd get a CD with it, like Power DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And you install that program, and then that does the decryption of the DVD in the drive for you.
Yeah.
But it wasn't encrypted on the whole pathway. It was just the CD is decrypted, and it just needed to decrypt in software. It was very low security compared.
And so why couldn't a Linux computer do the same? Why wasn't there software?
Before DECSS, which is what he used to crack it, it was an encrypted disk. You'd stick it in, and Linux go, this is an encrypted disk. I can't read it. I don't know the key. Mm-hmm. I don't know the combination to unlock the code on this CD.
And why wasn't
DVD.
There software available that would...
Because there's been... So open source, a lot of people have a misconception that open source automatically means free. It can mean free, but that tends to mean a little more hassle. It doesn't have to mean free. But this was especially back in the 90s, and in the earlier days of open source taking hold and not being quite as user-friendly as it is now. And so they weren't able... The software companies and hardware companies didn't see enough of a market to make it worthwhile to make any software or hardware available to decrypt the DVDs. And they also have DVDs that have the decryption in the players, too. Some of the newer versions have that as well. That's a prelude to this. But so you weren't able to play under any open source platform. If you weren't on Windows, maybe Mac, Windows or Mac, you were out of luck. And there were millions of people, especially outside of the United States, but all over, that were using alternative platforms to Windows and Mac. And they couldn't watch DVDs on their system. They bought the DVDs. They were legitimately theirs. But they couldn't watch them.
Gotcha.
So this hacker cracked this and made it publicly available. And then there was a big, nasty, nasty manhunt kind of effect from the U.S. government. Luckily, he was outside of the U.S. But every website that linked to the download was shut down and forced to remove the links. That's a whole other story. I can get into some other time. I've covered a little bit before. But because it was in violation of the DMCA, because it gave directions on how to bypass copy protection, so that's in violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Okay.
So that's what happened then. And again, it was cracked 2 weeks before it was even available to the public. So you have the same thing going on here. Manufacturers are paying a little bit more attention to open source and stuff than they did before, because it's really been growing. But and so there are actually starting to become more mainstream programs. But right now, in general distribution, you can't get a DVD player. You have to go download it from a site, and then you can watch your DVDs on your system. I've had to do that with SUSE Linux 10.2. Novell, to play it safe, so they don't have to play in the patent wars, intentionally leaves out the MP3 decoder as well as DVD decoder. But it's really easy to just go to the website and get it and install it. It takes 5 minutes, and you're up and running. But Novell just doesn't want to be in the middle of that ugliness. So it's out there. So, can you on with this? Did that answer that? Did that help clarify?
Yeah, I think so. I had one other question, though.
Shoot. Yes, go ahead.
Basically, talk about what encryption is. How does it work and why?
Okay. The basic, and I'm going to simplify this, so those of you who know a lot more about encryption, don't wince too heavily from my oversimplification here. But basically, you have an encryption key, and this is a code, you could say, that people that you've agreed to, and you can have two parts to it. One part of it, let's say, is on the DVD, and the other part of it would be in, let's say, the Power DVD software. And you have to have both pieces in order for the message to come through, whether it was PGP with email. You would have your encrypted email, and you'd send it to a friend. But if you didn't send him your public key to decrypt it with, which is easy to get, but if you didn't have the key on the other end, you can't decrypt it. And you would need a key from them so that you make sure you're sending it to them, and you can verify, because the numbers are an exact match. And those numbers are a set number of numbers and then randomly adjusted by mathematical formulae and usually some randomness from the system. Like if it's running a bunch of programs, and it'll scramble the numbers and it puts together this huge number. It looks like a bunch of gibberish of letters and numbers. But that is one big encryption key, and you have to know how to decode it on the other end. If you don't have the cipher to decrypt it with, it's like the old, if you look at the old Nazi code, the was it the Rosetta Stone? Or no? Oh, what was that? I'm suddenly drawing a blank on that. But you know, World War II, I can't believe I forget it.
When we broke with their submarines.
Yes, right, and we kept it because we figured out the cipher. We figured out the code, so we were able to intercept all of the messages. And what was the name of that? I'm suddenly drawing a blank. So anyway, it's the same type of thing. If the encryption's too weak, somebody can crack it just by brute force, by guessing and guessing and guessing and guessing and finally figuring it out and going, oh, it's not gibberish anymore. It makes sense. Okay. So that's the basic of it.
So the manufacturers of the software, I believe you called it Power?
PowerDVD is one of many manufacturers.
Okay. They somehow have gotten together with the content provider
right.
to decide on.
They licensed. They pay a license to the content provider to have the decryption keys.
Got you.
And be allowed to sell a product with the decryption keys.
Okay.
And then you buy a DVD, and it usually comes bundled with it because then you can't watch movies if you don't have it with it. So it's usually included in the price of the DVD player you buy.
Okay.
So that makes sense.
Yeah. So the Linux user, since he's not paying
all those extra licensing fees, right?
Type person
right.
fees, he
doesn't have the key.
He's not entitled to play the
right,
content.
Okay. Right, that's the argument. And there are plenty of Linux users who'd be more than happy to have a system that already had that included, because it's not a huge hit, at least it wasn't. In the past, it wasn't that expensive. It looks like the new costs are going to be significantly higher. There are plenty of Linux users who would have been happy if there was just a player for Linux, and there wouldn't have been such an energy to try to crack it.
And it simply comes down to the fact that there just aren't enough Linux users to justify.
Well, that's the argument. That's the argument that the business that the manufacturers have used. And again, this was the 90s when it was a lot smaller market. Linux was a lot harder to use. It was just for the hardcore techies. Wasn't for the general user. My wife and kids wouldn't be using it. You know, they are now. Even the six-year-old, you know, they use it just fine.
Right.
So it's plenty user-friendly now. But in the past, it wasn't. It was very much more for the hardcore techies.
So is there another argument? Is there another
reason? What's the argument now?
Well...
Well, part of it, too, is a lot of the corporations are very nervous about the whole open source community because they don't agree with the concept of open disclosure, of everything is out there for peer review.
Okay.
The open source idea is that everything's out there and you can see everything, and that way you can find flaws, and if you feel like you can fix it. Or you can take the code and turn it into something else, and you can turn around and sell it if you want, as long as you give full credit and you supply the source code that you did it with. There's different licenses under open source. That's just one of several licenses. And a lot of closed source companies like Microsoft and others do not get the benefits of. They just don't understand how there's money to be made from that. And there are companies out there making money, like IBM, Novell, Sun. They have mixtures of programs. Some of it's open, some of it's closed. But they have found that there is a huge opportunity for it. And there tends to be the release cycles tend to be a little slower than your typical. Closed source product, depending upon the size of the company and the software base. But what happens is, overall, if you get a really good base of developers, instead of just having a few thousand developers, you can have hundreds of thousands of developers helping add to your code to make your finding and breaking and fixing it all on their own.
Right.
And that's a huge boon to any company that can capitalize on that efficiently without alienating their people at the same time, which has been known to happen.
Right.
So there's a huge... But it goes back to being more of a service industry and less of a software industry. You know, way back when, it was you bought all the hardware and then the software kind of just came with it and you paid for service and support, IBM, when it was, you know, the big hardware or the digital PDPs way back when. And then Microsoft, actually, Bill Gates, really is to credit for the whole concept of software licensing and software piracy. Prior to that, it wasn't. There was a lot of sharing between different companies. They would share snippets of code with each other to help. Say, hey, I've got this problem here. I can't seem to make this. It's using up too much memory and it runs wild. Can you take a look at this code? And you know, somebody working at IBM would be talking to somebody in digital, and they would share. You know, they wouldn't share the whole code base, but they'd share snippets. And it was a quasi open source environment. And then Microsoft came in and came with, oh no, this is our secret sauce. Do not share this. And so that. that has taken hold and taken off, but in the last 15, 20 years, there's been kind of a switch against that because they're seeing the bugs and the poor coding practices, the sloppy code in general. The word hacker, I covered this in a different show, used to just mean somebody would hack away at code to make it more efficient, leaner and meaner, and run better. They'd literally take away the bits and bytes that were not necessary to get the best piece of code to run it really efficiently, because back in the 70s, the paper tape machines and the cards, you had very, very limited memory. You were lucky if you had 4K of memory. That was a pretty beefy computer back then. And so you needed really efficient programming. Well, as systems became more powerful, programmers became lazier, and the standards got sloppier. And so in the closed source environment, you get kind of in, and I've worked in both. I've worked in both closed and open source environments, both large and small. And you get into a little bubble of your own world. Whereas with open source, you can have entire third parties with a completely fresh perspective looking at things and going, wait a minute, you just opened up a huge security hole writing that line there. Here's what you could do to change that and fix it. And so you have peer review at the most grand scale beyond even IBM's resources. And you know, IBM has huge resources, but it really opens it up to a much broader range. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You see the pro. I mean, there's pros and cons. You know, a lot of the security people say, oh, it's really bad to have all that out there in the open. It's like you're hanging out there with your shorts in the wind.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, wait a minute. If it's going to get cracked sooner or later, wouldn't you rather it's cracked before you started relying on it? Wouldn't you rather have all that peer review and so that you keep improving it, improving it, improving it until it finally is solidified? And so there are open source encryption algorithms out there that have been able to hold up under the test of time because of that kind of peer review that a lot of the closed source encryption has not been able to hold up to. And so you see it with Microsoft. Microsoft epitomizes closed source. And look at how frustrated people are with the viruses, the spyware, the malware, the corruption, the crashing, all the different issues that people complain about with Windows all the time. And you know, there's a number of reasons for that, but one of them is the closed source approach, is you have too many people with the same perspective looking at the code, rather than a variety of perspectives that could look up different ways to solve a problem more efficiently. And so you end up, and they get this huge code base. It's not lean. It's, oh, let's make everybody upgrade to more hardware. So is that help?
Yeah.
Okay. So continue on with reading from here. It says, in other words, if you've sunk a pile of money into a high-end audio setup fed from an SPDIF digital output, there's a little connector on there called SPDIF, you won't be able to use it with protected content. Say you just bought Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, released as a Super Audio CD in its 30th anniversary edition in 2003, and you want to play it under Vista. Since the SPDIF link to your amplifier speakers is regarded as insecure, not encrypted, Vista disables it. So you end up hearing a performance by Marcel Marceau instead of Pink Floyd. Those who aren't familiar with that reference, Marcel Marceau is a famous mime. So you hear nothing. Similarly, component video will be disabled by Vista's content protection. What if you're lucky enough to have bought a video card that supports HDMI digital video with HDCP content protection? So that's the high-definition media interface. That's the connector. I have one on my laptop here. So you can hook up, like, your laptop to a big-screen TV, LCD or whatever. And it even has the HDCP content protection, the supposed encryption between the connectors. Well, there's a good chance you'll have to go out and buy another video card that really does support HDCP, because until near the end of 2006, unfortunately, the market actually didn't really support it. Even the vendors advertising that claimed it did didn't support it. As the site that first broke the story put it in the article, the great HDCP fiasco puts, none of the AGP or PCI Express graphics cards that you could buy today as of 2006 support HDCP. If you've just spent $1,000 on a pair of Radeon X19 XT graphics cards, expecting to be able to play back HD DVD or Blu-ray movies at 1920 by 1080 resolution in the future, you've just wasted your money. If you just spent $1,500 on a pair of 7800 GTX 512 megabyte GPUs, graphics processing units, expecting to be able to play 1920 by 1080 HD DVD or Blu-ray DVD movies in the future, you've just wasted your money. The two devices mentioned above are the premium, supposedly HDCP-enabled cards made by the two major graphics chipset manufacturers, ATI and NVIDIA. ATI was later subject to a class action lawsuit by its customers over this deception. As late as August of 2006, when Sony announced its Blu-ray drive for PCs, it had to face the embarrassing fact that its Blu-ray drive couldn't actually play Blu-ray discs in high-definition format. Remember that whole fiasco? That's why they had to hold up on the PS3s and everything. They found out that they weren't actually ready to go. Quote from CNET, a major technical website and magazine. Since there are currently no personal computers for sale offering graphics chips that support HDCP, this isn't yet possible. I think this changed right around the end of December, but this document was updated just a few days ago by the author. In order to appropriately protect content, Vista will probably have to disable any special device features that it can't directly control, which in practice is the vast majority of the device drivers. ASIO support is standard for new C-Media sound cards, and it would probably have to be disabled because it doesn't meet the Vista standards. As well as overt disabling of functionality, there's also covert disabling of functionality. For example, personal computer voice communications, like talking over the internet. That's become a pretty popular thing to save on long-distance bills, etc. Because most of those systems aren't encrypted to Vista standard, a lot of them will be disabled, especially if they're doing any other content at the same time. The downgrading disabling is dynamic. So if the premium content signal is intermittent or varies, for example, music that fades out, various outputs and output quality will fade in and out, or turn on and off in sync. Normally, this behavior would be a trigger for reinstalling device drivers or even a warranty return of the affected hardware. But in this case, it's just a signal that everything is functioning as intended. Decreased playback quality. Alongside the all-or-nothing approach of disabling output, Vista requires that any interface that provides high-quality output degrade the signal quality that passes through it if premium content is present. This is done through a constrictor that downgrades the signal to a much lower quality one, then upscales it again back to the original spec, but with a significant loss in quality. So if you're using an expensive new LCD display fed from a high-quality DVI signal on your video card, and there's protected content present, the picture you're going to see will be, as the spec puts it, slightly fuzzy, a bit like a 10-year-old monitor that you picked up for $2 at a yard sale. As an example of an experience that's likely to become commonplace once more premium content is rolled out, Roger Strong reports from Canada that, "I've just had my first experience with HD content being blocked. I purchased an HP Media Center PC with a built-in HD DVD player, together with a 24-inch high-definition 1920x1200 flat-panel display. They even included a high-definition movie, The Bourne Supremacy. Sure enough, the movie won't play, because while the video card supports HDCP content protection, the monitor doesn't. It plays if I connect an old 14-inch VGA CRT monitor to the DVI to VGA connector." MuSlix64, that's the guy who cracked the HD DVD. He tells a similar tale. "When I disable my high-definition monitor, I can watch the movie on my old VGA screen. But what is the point of having a high-definition monitor and high-definition content and not being able to watch a high-definition movie on it?" MuSlix64 was so upset at not being able to play his legitimately purchased movies on his legitimately purchased monitor attached to his legitimately purchased player that he broke the AACS protection, that's their new encryption method, just to be able to see his own movies. And so I think I mentioned a little earlier how, yeah, about the HD DVD and Blu-ray, how that has been hacked, but that with each revision of the discs and such, they can blacklist it and make it so it's unhacked, basically, in effect, as you get updates or put new content in your player. The same deliberate degrading of playback quality applies to audio, with the audio being downgraded to sound from the spec fuzzy with less detail. So it's both audio and video is affected by this. Let's see, how many others? Okay, so this gets into what's it going to take to run Vista. What kind of hardware, what kind of computer are you going to need to run this operating system that has all this encryption running? The demands are pretty high. It was a big, when XP came out, everybody, you know, had to upgrade all their PCs. It gave a big spike to the Intel PC market and AMD and such. Well, here's what we get to look forward to with Vista. The Microsoft specs say that only display devices with more than 520,000 pixels will have their images degraded, but conveniently omit to mention that this resolution, roughly 800 by 600, covers pretty much every output device that will ever be used with Vista. Not many people go below 800 by 600 anymore. The absolute minimum requirement for Vista Basic is listed as 800-600 resolution with an 800 megahertz Pentium 3 with 512 megs of RAM, and he puts it as wildly optimistic. However, that won't get you the Vista Aero interface, the new fancy schmancy eye candy, which makes it more or less pointless to go to Vista instead of XP. Even XP on an 800 MHz P3 isn't the snappiest. The minimum requirements for running Aero on, and that's A-E-R-O, by the way, on a Vista premium PC are, I don't even know all of these specs, DX9 GPU, so graphics processing unit, 128 mega RAM of video RAM on it, pixel shader 2.0, the minimum resolution of 1024 by 768 32 bits. For Aero Glass, it's even higher than that, in addition to the minimum resolution supported by the LCD panel, 1024 by 768 for a 15-inch LCD. So yeah, you have to have a pretty beefy system just to run the operating system. Forget even getting to the media. Beyond the obvious playback quality implications of deliberately downgrading output, this measure can have serious repercussions in applications where high-quality reproduction of content is vital. For example, the field of medical imaging either bans outright or strongly frowns on any form of lossy compression because artifacts introduced by the compression process can cause misdiagnosis, and extreme cases can even be life-threatening. And he goes into an example of how that could happen, because a lot of I've done audits, HIPAA audits, on medical industry places, and you'll see people playing like an audio CD on the computer there. They're going through the imagery of a CAT scan or an X-ray or whatever, and while they're out there playing an audio CD or something like that. Well, if they do that with Vista on there, there's a good chance, because of the downgrade in quality, it's going to make the images a lot harder to read and could lead to some serious consequences from that. Mm. But that's not the worst of what could happen. And I've mentioned before on shows that those who've been purchasing Xboxes, like the Xbox 360 and its predecessors, have actually been supporting this development of content protection. That's where Microsoft was able to do a lot of its experimenting on the market with its content protection concepts and funding it. They found a way to get people to pay for them to add all this digital rights management to PCs. And it really was, their primary goal was to use the Xbox to fund trying to figure out digital rights management. Secondary to that was, you know, competition and getting into the game market and profitability, etc., which they've done well with that. In order for this to work, the spec requires that the operational details of the device be kept confidential. So this is the impact on open source and non-Windows platforms. So the way it works right now is a lot of vendors have been becoming more and more open about, here's how you can write a driver for our hardware, so that you can write a driver for your video card for Linux or Mac or Windows, whatever. Here's the specification to follow. Go ahead and write your code. Well, the Vista requirement says you have to keep that information confidential, because it'll make it too easy to bypass the encryption. So unfortunately, what that means is the only way to protect the content protection system is to not release any technical details on the device without people having to sign NDAs and non-disclosure agreements, etc. This closing of the PC's historically open platform is an extremely worrying trend. A quarter of a century ago, IBM made the momentous decision to make their PC an open platform by publishing complete hardware details and allowing anyone to compete on the open market. Many small companies, the traditional garage startup, got their start through this. This openness is what created the PC industry and the reason why most homes, rather than just a few offices, as had been the case until then, have one or more PCs sitting in a corner somewhere. This seems to be a return to the bad old days of 25 years ago, when only privileged insiders were able to participate. So that you know, and also because before they were able to do unified drivers, like they could write one driver that worked for a whole bunch of sound cards, now you have to write specific drivers for each and every card for each and every configuration. So that makes a lot more work for the developers.
And why is that again?
Because they have to write the decryption encryption algorithms to be specific to any other hardware that they're interfacing with. They're going to have to write the code for that interface between this piece of hardware and that piece of hardware, and decrypting it between as it flows through the sound card or whatever. Does that make sense?
And this is just new to Vista?
This is all Vista's requirements. They're requiring that hardware vendors meet all these specifications in order to keep from the content protection being hacked.
So are we not just talking about high-definition content? I mean, is
unfortunately, this will affect everything. Yes, that's the problem. That's the ramification of this, is that, fine, you don't care about high-definition content, that's fine, but if you care at all about running any operating system besides Windows Vista, and I don't mean just Windows, I mean specifically Windows Vista, you're out of luck. Because, for example, not only can they not do the one size fits all, but also vendors get tired of supporting a product after a year or two, right? They're not going to write drivers. They want to sell their new product. So if your video card becomes a year or two old, obsolete, but it gets revoked because there's a driver bug that Vista finds, so they decertify you, the vendor is not going to want to spend more resources to rewrite the driver to fix the bug to get it recertified. They're just going to tell people to go and get a new video card.
Right.
So that's going to cause just huge complications across the board, again, even with non-Windows systems, because they won't, Microsoft will not allow a vendor, they won't enable the product to do high definition or sometimes to even work under Vista if they don't meet the certification. So, and since they're 95% of the market, most hardware vendors are going to scramble to try to get that certification. And that's going to make it so you can't run it under another operating system, because they won't be able to write the drivers for any other operating system, and they won't make the spec available for somebody else to write the drivers, which is what they've let people do in the past.
So will this also encourage or force people to migrate to Vista?
That's the idea. It'll force people off of old Windows platforms, because there's still people on 95 even. Microsoft hates that. It's the old car syndrome, you know. There's a lot of people out there who hate that. Like, I've had a couple 67 Mustangs myself, and I'm driving a hybrid Prius now, but you know, and they're trying to figure out, how do you get all these old cars off the highway? How do you get all these people off their old systems? They're too happy with them. Right. Well, take away all the support for the hardware so that they don't have a choice.
Do you have any idea how it breaks down percentage-wise, large commercial users of Microsoft's operating systems versus, you know, one time?
There's a number of websites that break all that down. I don't have that off the top of my head. The overall rough general market share of complete Microsoft market is about 95%, at least in the US. I don't know what it is worldwide. So that leaves 5% that gets haggled over between Mac and Linux and BSD and Solaris, and all those other people scramble for the scraps of 5 or 6%. How much of that's XP versus 2000 versus NT versus 95, 98? There's a number of websites that you can go look that up. They all have kind of conflicting numbers. They vary considerably. Some of them are based on, you know, browser hits, and it determines what OS they hit with. Others have other methods of trying to calculate it. So I don't know what the exact numbers are, but it's still in the millions, apparently, as far as, I mean, I know tons of people in Windows 2000, a lot of companies that still haven't left NT in 2000 because of the problems with XP.
Right.
So this will be a way to encourage people to go to Vista and not hold back to Windows 2000, for example, because what will happen is the hardware will no longer be, they won't be providing new drivers for it, and they won't be able to get new hardware but still run on 2000. The other one, so then denial of service via driver revocation. Once a weakness is found in a particular driver or device, the driver will have its signature revoked by Microsoft, which means that it will cease to function. What this means is that a report of a compromise of a particular driver or device will cause all support for that device worldwide to be turned off until a fix can be found. An interesting potential security threat suggested by Carl Sigman occurs when Vista is being used to run a security monitoring system such as a video surveillance system. If it's possible to convince Vista that what it's communicating is premium content, the video and or audio surveillance content will become unavailable. And then he says, I can just see this as a plot element in Ocean's 15 or Mission Impossible 6. It's okay. Their surveillance system is running Vista. We can shut it down with spoofed premium content. And he says here, their lawyers must have been asleep when they let themselves get painted into this particular corner. The first time a revocation takes out a hospital, foreign government department, air traffic control system, or whatever, they've guaranteed themselves a front row seat in court proceedings for the rest of their natural lives. Because this has opened up a whole new way to do denial of service. Now, do you understand what a denial of service attack is from hacker lingo?
No.
All right. Code Red and a few other worms a number of years ago, they took out like eBay. eBay became unavailable. You tried to go to the website and it says, server timed out, I can't connect. So you were denied the service of that website. You can't get to it because they sent hundreds of thousands of packets of data and overloaded the server, so the servers either crashed or just couldn't respond fast enough to all the data. So in effect, they denied everybody else, legitimate users, any access. So he's talking about, let's say, a hacker gets a worm on your system, and you know, so somebody opens an email inappropriately, and it's able to trick the system into thinking that all your content is content is premium, and that the video driver is not valid, and now all the video cards in the entire corporation, every computer that gets infected, will just be disabled. You'll have no video. And you have no way to update it and no way to roll it back until Microsoft makes it available through an update. Well, what if it's your network card that gets disabled? How do you get it? If you have 10,000 systems, and I've worked at places like that, you're going to have to have sysadmins running around with a CD or a USB drive or something, some way to try to get the fix onto each system individually. This makes it a lot easier for hackers to mess up systems than it ever was before, unfortunately. Now, of course, you mentioned about what was the Microsoft One service.
Live One Care.
Live One, you know, and Care to try to fight this. But, you know, we'll see how that goes. But, for example, Symantec and McAfee, you know, a number of years ago were listed by the NSA and such as the products to have in your systems. They've been downgraded. You know, they were number one and two. Now they're downgraded to, like, 9 and 10 as far as the products to protect because they can't keep up with the constant threat of worms, viruses, malware, and spyware. It's kind of a losing battle when you're on a platform that is so vulnerable. So even with Microsoft's best intentions to try to provide that extra security through their service offerings and updates, they're still setting up a huge problem here when you have these fundamental vulnerabilities being added. You know, everybody was hoping, this is my personal take on it, is that Microsoft worked really hard to improve the security of the latest version of Windows with Vista. And they obviously put a lot of work into it. The problem is they put all the security effort into protecting content and content providers, not the end user. There's not any significant improvements on user protection for security of credit cards and phishing and email, all the issues that have plagued Windows users for all these years. There's not any really huge improvements. There's little tweaks here and there. And yet they must have spent a huge amount of money, time, and resources to come up with this complex content protection system. And if they would have spent half, a quarter of that time on the end user instead of placating the media industry, I think we'd be pretty happy with the result of Windows coming out. I mean, I'm only hammering on this because, as I agree with him, if something's broken, that's not good. You want the right tool.
Right.
And when somebody messes it up like this, it's very frustrating, especially when they dominate the market this way. So we'll see what happens with that. And he talks about how if a vendor isn't interested in rewriting a driver, once it's found to be compromised, then that device becomes useless. And you have to just go buy a new device and hope that it stays working. In addition to this is a Windows anti-piracy component, the WGA, that came out. They rolled it out this summer with XP. I don't know if you experienced this or saw people, but they were getting a little thing saying, your product is not authentic, a little floating thing, and you couldn't log in right away. And this would happen to people who, for example, they'd shared their CD key for their Windows registration, like Windows XP registration or something like that. So there's a delay before they get in their system, and they've got this constant little annoying thing, and they're supposed to purchase an upgrade and get a legitimate license. Except that I saw this happening with like brand new systems out of the box from Toshiba and Sony and others. We're getting these when in August when the update first pushed out. Well, it turns out there was a bug. It was mislabeling. And they pushed out some updates later on that fixed a lot of those bugs, but they were having problems with that. Well, combining the two together is the WGA is based a lot on hardware. If you change too much of your hardware, it says you've violated your software. The WGA will do that. If you change your motherboard, it'll say, oh, you don't have a legitimate version of Windows. What? All I did was change my motherboard. And it's just the way they do their algorithm based on the hardware. Well, it's going to make it even worse with Vista, because if a piece of hardware gets deactivated, even temporarily, and you swap in a different video card or sound card to avoid the problem, you then risk triggering Windows anti-piracy measures, landing you in more hot water. So you can see how this creates a whole cascade effect of issues. And then, to top it all of this protection can easily be bypassed with an HTML to DVI amplifier, which is an easily available and inexpensive piece of hardware, so all this hassle for attempted digital rights management is worthless. Worse than worthless, because of all the problems it causes. Now, that's my wording summary of what he goes into a lot here, but he basically states how, you know, you can just plug into the HDMI port with a thing that'll decrypt it that's supposedly legitimate. Now, but since that's a rogue device, it can be revoked. But if that device is revoked and it's using a common chipset that's used across the board, that means hundreds of thousands or even millions of other consumer devices that use the same chip will also be revoked, even though they're being used differently. So you can see there's just the landslide effect here is just amazing. So this is a quote from Engadget, good review of the scenario. Vista will revoke any driver that is found to be leaking premium content. If the same driver is used for all the manufacturer's chip designs, then a revocation would cause all that company's products to need a new driver. So that's all across the board. And then they talk about how they can push new keys and update the keys. And I'm going to wrap it up here because this went longer than I intended. But, I mean, there's just so much more here. And, again, you can read about it if you go to the TechTalkHawk.com website. There's a link to the whole document. I also have the rest of the summary and notes on there. The other thing is that all the costs for the vendors are going through the roof because of the programming that they have to do for both hardware and software, and they're going to have to pass those costs along to the customer. So hardware in general is going to go up rather than down. It's going to change the whole trend of cheap computers and getting cheaper. They're going to go up instead. The only other thing here is that this is what blows my mind. The content industry... Oh, and I should let you know that you're listening to KYRSLP Spokane, Thin Air Community Radio, 89.9 FM, also heard on 92.3 FM, www.kyrs.org. Get that in there just in time. The content industry dictates design requirements to hardware manufacturers now. Content industry being like Disney, MGM, 20th Century Fox, Sony, etc. The evidence of, this is in the Microsoft documents, the evidence of security must be presented to Hollywood and other content, or actually, I'm sorry, this is a researcher, Ed Felton, quoted from Microsoft documents. Yeah, that's it. The evidence of security must be presented to Hollywood and other content owners, and they must agree that it provides the required level of security. Written proof from at least three of the major Hollywood studios is required in order for the driver to pass certification.
Wow.
Disney, MGM, 20th Century Fox give you the go-ahead. They're the ones who get to authorize whether your video card is authorized. Holy moly.
So obviously, if Microsoft's willing to go down this path, it seems like they're taking a risk and opening an opportunity for maybe open source to be even more attractive.
Well, I see two potential... I mean, so there's two extreme potentials here. One is Microsoft somehow pulls this off, and everybody walks the party line, and the vendors comply, and they succeed in killing off all open source and all competitors, and everything is Windows. So that's one extreme. That's the goal. The other extreme is this creates a huge backlash, legal issues, everything else. Microsoft yet again gets found guilty of monopolistic things, which they've already been found guilty before, but they get slaps on the wrist. $20 million to them is nothing. And they get broken up finally, like what happened to AT&T or whatever. That's the other extreme. And then open source and Mac. Mac gets a big boon out of it, and open source, and they take like 15-20% of the market, and Microsoft loses a big chunk. Those are the two extremes. Reality will probably be somewhere in the middle. I hope more towards the latter than the former. Only time will tell what happens with the market and all of this. In response to what you're asking, there was a portion in here I read that is specific to that. If I can just find that here. Okay. Well, let me read this. This just tells you. So you've heard of the KISS principle, right?
No.
Keep it simple, stupid. The more complexity you add, the more things that can go wrong. Like the difference between a fully loaded Cadillac with all the amenities and just a nice, simple, basic, I don't know, Toyota or something.
Right.
The Cadillac's going to have a lot more things go wrong just simply because it has more things to go wrong. It's just the odds are you're going to have issues with your power windows. You're going to have issues with your power logs. You're going to have issues with your satellites, you know. You just have more things that can break.
Right.
Your little Toyota is just going to keep running if you know, because it doesn't have all those extra things. They just have those key parts. So in the block diagram, looking at the block diagram, Vista's Media Interoperability Gateway, of the 11 components that make up MIG, the Media Interoperability Gateway, only two of those 11 components, the audio and video decoders, are actually used to render content. The remaining nine are used to apply content protection measures. So, I don't know how many exponents that is of complexity. So, he sums it up here in just a minute about, because it goes on, I mean, the list is, let's see, there was one other example I wanted to give about the Navy, and talking about, and then I'll wrap it up here, because we'll get back into the Synthetic Zen Show music segment. And again, normally my show isn't on one specific topic like this. This is just since this is only about 24 days away before this comes out, I really thought I'd try to get the word out to people about how serious this next version of Windows is and the impact of on the entire industry, not just Windows users. Mac users should be concerned about this as well. One of the things he summarizes here is he says, at the end of all this, the question remains, why is Microsoft going to this much trouble? Ask most people what they picture when you use the term premium content media player, and they'll respond with a PVR or a DVD player, not a Windows PC. So why go to this much effort to try and turn the PC into something that's not? Well, in 2006, Cory Doctorow published an analysis of the anti-competitive nature of Apple's iTunes copy restriction system. Apple's copy protection isn't just bad for consumers, it's bad for business. July 31st, 2006. The only reason you can imagine why Microsoft would put its programmers, device vendors, third-party developers, and ultimately its customers through this much pain is because once this copy protection is entrenched, Microsoft will completely own the distribution channel in the same way that Apple has managed to acquire a monopolistic lock-in on their music distribution channel. In the same way that Apple has already dictated terms back to the music industry, play by Apple's rules or we won't carry your content. Do you get that? Does that make sense?
I don't know enough about it, but...
All right, so Recording Industry Association of America, everybody's heard about the lawsuits and stuff and how they want to make money, and so, you know, Napster got shut down and then reincarnated, and none of the pay-for-money online sites are making money. Apple comes up with a way to do it with the iPod and iTunes, and they make money. They made an original deal with the RIAA, and the RIAA, when they saw it was profitable, said, hey, well, we want you to charge a higher rate now because we want to make more of a profit. And Apple said, no. They said, no, you agreed to these terms. We're sticking to it because we don't want to eat our profit and we'll drive people away. So then the RIAA threatened to take them to court, and it went back and forth. And basically they backed off. And they're, you know, so they had to eat humble pie there because Apple was actually generating profit and they didn't want to lose what little profit they had by taking away the entire license. Right. So Apple was able to dictate to the media industry what the terms were, because they had a channel of distribution. So, his theory is Microsoft wants to make the PC a channel of distribution for movies and audio, and once Microsoft has control of that, then they can turn around and dictate to the media industry what the terms are, and they'll be in control. Does that make sense?
It does. If we buy into the PC becoming the...
Becoming, media. Right. And, you know, they've been trying for 20 years to try to make it the center of the home hub. I remember when I worked a retail place, which I was CIO at, we had these literal multimedia systems that were the center of the computer with the TV and all of that, and they've never really quite taken off. People have always gone with the component approach instead.
Any idea why you can't buy Media Center Edition of XP as a standalone product, why you have to buy it with a system?
I have no idea on that. That's a good question. I didn't know that that was a limitation, but I get that that would make sense. Yeah, I do not know.
Interesting.
That would be something to look into. So he sums it up with, here's an offer to Microsoft. If we, the consumers, promise never, ever, ever to buy a single HD DVD or Blu-ray disc containing any precious premium content, will you in exchange withhold this poison from the computer industry, please? So it's a long thing. I hope it enlightened people, gave you some feedback, got you thinking about things, and realize that there's alternatives. Maybe contact Microsoft. Maybe contact your local senator. You know, this is, I mean, this, if this doesn't fit into monopolistic practices by dictating the entire industry, I mean, they were found guilty of monopoly with just the Netscape browser wars and bundling Internet Explorer, and they were found guilty of corruption with Java and corrupting Java and being in violation of their terms of the license with Sun there. This blows away, the impact of this blows away any of those quote-unquote minor issues. But if nobody complains about it, and if, because nobody knows about it, nobody understands what's going on, then it'll just happen. And so I hope that this wasn't just too dry and too dull for people. I hope got people thinking and enlightened a little bit. I'll be back to my normal show format next week, where I read more headlines and cover more diverse topics and won't go on quite so long-winded on the same topic. And Randy will be able to continue here, keep me grounded so I don't go off into too much techno gobbledygook babble that makes people completely fuzz over. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I'm going to switch to the Synthetic Zen show shortly here, and we'll get the music on, world music and other music. I'll probably be playing a lot of Dead Can Dance tonight, just feeling like mellowing out with them. And not to be confused with Grateful Dead, I know you give me that look, because Dead Can Dance is very world music. It's a duo, man and a woman, who are really impressive and very talented. And so I'll be playing that shortly. If you have any comments or feedback, I'd love to hear from you. And phone's starting to ring, and I'm going to cue this up and answer it, and you have a good one out there.